The kind of ignorance is twofold. The one simple, complete lack of understanding. The other double, whenever someone is not only gripped by lack of knowledge, but also thinks he knows what he does not know at all, being puffed up by a false opinion of wisdom. The former evil, then, is the lesser, being the cause of lighter and perhaps unintentional faults, while the second is the greater, for it gives birth to great wrongs, not only unintentional ones, but already premeditated acts of injustice. It seems to me that Lot, the begetter of daughters, is especially afflicted about these matters, being unable to raise up in his soul a male and perfect plant. For he had two daughters by the woman who was turned to stone, whom, using a well-aimed name, one might call habit, a nature hostile to truth, one that, whenever someone leads it forward, lags behind and keeps looking back at what is old and familiar, remaining fixed in their midst like a lifeless pillar. Of the daughters, the elder will be called deliberation, and the younger assent, for assent follows deliberation, but no one who has assented still deliberates. So the mind, seated in its own council chamber, begins to set its daughters in motion. With the elder, deliberation, to examine and investigate each matter. With the younger, assent, to nod readily at whatever comes along and to embrace hostile things as if they were friendly, provided they offer some small bait of pleasure of their own accord. Sober reasoning does not tolerate this, but reasoning held fast by drunkenness does, being, so to speak, out of its wine. That is why it is said, "They made their father drink wine." Gen 19:33. Complete insensibility, to think it sufficient for the mind either to deliberate on its own about what is advantageous, or to assent to whatever appears in any way at all, as though such things held the truth fixed within themselves, when human nature is in no way whatsoever capable either of finding certainty by careful examination, or of choosing some things as true and advantageous, while turning away from others as false and causes of harm. For a great darkness, lying over things that exist over bodies and events, does not allow the nature of each to be seen. But even if someone, forced by curiosity or love of learning, wishes to peer within, like those who are maimed, stumbling over what lies at his feet, before grasping anything he falls back and is left behind, or, groping with his hands, he merely guesses at what is unclear, gaining conjecture in place of truth. For not even if education, carrying its torch, were to escort the mind, having kindled its own light toward the sight of what exists, could it do more good than harm. For a small light is naturally quenched by a great darkness, and once it is quenched, all sight is useless. One who prides himself either on his ability to deliberate, or on being sufficiently capable of choosing some things and avoiding others, must be reminded of the following. If the same unvarying impressions always happen to arise from the same objects, it would perhaps be necessary to admire the two criteria naturally furnished within us, sense perception and mind, as free from falsehood and incorruptible, and, hesitating about nothing, to trust the things that have once appeared, and on that basis, choose some and turn away from the opposite others. But since we find ourselves moved differently by these same things, we could say nothing certain about anything, since what appears does not remain fixed but undergoes changes of many kinds and many forms. For when the impression is unstable, the judgment based upon it must necessarily be unstable too. There are many causes of this. First, the countless differences among living creatures, not in one respect but in almost every respect. Differences in their origin and constitution, in their food and ways of life, in their preferences and aversions, in their sense activities and movements, in the peculiarities of their innumerable bodily and psychic affections. For apart from those who judge, some also of the things judged, such as the chameleon and the octopus. The one, they say, changes its color to match the ground over which it is accustomed to crawl, while the other matches the rocks under the sea which it happens to grasp. Nature, provident for their safety, having perhaps granted them this change into many colors as a remedy averting harm to their capture. And have you not observed the neck of the dove, in the rays of the sun, changing through countless varieties of color? Does it not take on crimson and dark blue, fiery and coal-like, and again pale and red and every kind of splendid color, whose very names it is not even easy to remember? They also say that among the Scythians called the Gelei, a most astonishing creature occurs. Rarely, but it does occur, called the Tarandros, not inferior in size to an ox, and most similar to a deer in the shape of its face. It is said that this animal is always changing the color of its hair to match the regions, the trees, and simply everything near which it happens to stand. So that, because of the resemblance of color, it escapes the notice of those who encounter it, and is hard to hunt because of this rather than because of any bodily strength. These facts, then, and others like them, are clear proofs of the impossibility of certain apprehension, and next come the varieties that occur, no longer among all living creatures generally, but among human beings individually in relation to one another, concerning everything. These facts, then, and others like them, are clear proofs of our incapacity to grasp things. And beyond the differences among all animals, there is also the private variation of human beings among themselves about everything. For it is not only that the same people judge the same things differently at different times, but different people judge them in opposite ways, taking pleasure and displeasure in the very same things but in reverse. What displeased some delighted others, and conversely, what some drew to themselves as friendly and welcomed as their own, others cast far away as foreign and hostile. I have often, for instance, been present in the theater and seen how, at a single melody sung by one of the tragic or lyric performers competing on stage, some were so moved that, as though roused from sleep, they joined unwillingly in the chant of praise, while others sat so unaffected that they might be judged to differ in no way from the lifeless benches on which they were seated. And still others were so alienated that they got up and left the performance altogether, even shaking out both ears with their hands, for fear that some lingering echo might work an unpleasant reverberation upon souls so difficult and hard to please. But why do I say this? Each single person, taken by himself, and this is the most paradoxical thing, undergoes countless changes and turns in both body and soul, at one time choosing and at another rejecting the very same things, though they have not changed at all but remain constituted by nature exactly as they were. For the same things do not tend to affect us the same way when we are healthy and when we are sick, nor when we are awake and when we are asleep, nor in youth and in old age. And indeed a person standing still and a person in motion receives different impressions, likewise one who is confident and one who is afraid, and further one who is grieving and one who is rejoicing, one who loves and, conversely, one who hates. And why should I go on at length troubling over these things? To put it briefly, every motion of body and soul, whether according to nature or contrary to nature, is the cause of the unstable flux in what appears to us, since conflicting and discordant impressions assail it. And this instability in our impressions arises not least from position, from distance, and from the places in which each thing is contained. Do we not see fish in the sea, when they swim about with their fins spread, always appearing larger than they really are? And oars, too, however perfectly straight they may be, appear bent when seen through water. Indeed, false impressions cast upon things at the greatest distance regularly deceive the mind. Lifeless things have sometimes been suspected to be living creatures, and conversely living things lifeless. Things standing still have seemed to move, and things in motion to stand still. Things approaching have seemed to withdraw, and things withdrawing to approach again. The longest things have seemed the shortest, and many-sided things round. And countless other falsehoods are painted by plain sight, none of which a sensible person would sign off on as certain. And what of quantities in things that are compounded? For according to more or less, harms and benefits arise, as with countless other things, and especially with the drugs used in the medical art. For quantity in mixtures is measured by fixed limits and rules, within which it is not safe to fall short, nor beyond which to advance, for the lesser amount weakens, and the greater overstrains the potency. And each is harmful, the one unable to act through weakness, the other harming by forcing through excessive strength, and likewise with smoothness and roughness, density and compaction, and, conversely, looseness and dispersal. This clearly establishes the same test for what helps and what harms. But surely no one is unaware of this too, that almost nothing among existing things is understood from itself and by itself alone, but is judged by being set beside its opposite, the small beside the great, the dry beside the wet, the hot beside the cold, the heavy beside the light, the black beside the white, the weak beside the strong, the few beside the many. In just the same way, whatever pertains to virtue or to vice is recognized. The beneficial through the harmful, the noble by contrast with the shameful, the just and generally good by comparison with the unjust and the bad, and indeed all the beautiful things one might find in the world, if one considers them, take on the same pattern of judgment. For each thing by itself is beyond our grasp, but seems to be known through comparison with something else. And whatever cannot bear witness to itself, but needs the advocacy of something else, is unstable as grounds for certainty. So that on this score too, those who readily affirm or deny anything whatsoever stand refuted. And what wonder is there in this? For anyone who goes further into the matter and examines things more purely will come to know this, that not one single thing presents itself to us in its own simple nature, but all things display the most intricate blendings and mixtures. Take colors, for instance, how do we perceive them? Is it not together with air and light, external things, and with the moisture in the eye itself? And how is sweetness or bitterness tested? Is it not by means of the fluids native to our own mouths, whether natural or unnatural? Surely so. And again, do the scents that come from things burned as incense not present the simple and pure natures of the bodies themselves? Or rather do they present natures blended from those bodies together with the air, and sometimes also with the fire that melts the bodies, and with the faculty at work in the nostrils? From this it follows that we perceive neither colors as such, but the blend composed from the underlying things and the light, nor scents as such, but a mixture formed from what streams off the bodies and the all-receiving air, nor flavors as such, but what arises from the thing tasted meeting the moist substance in the mouth. Since matters stand this way, it is fitting to condemn as foolishness, rashness, or boastfulness those who readily venture to affirm or deny anything whatsoever. For if the simple potencies are out of reach, while the mixed ones, blended from several, lie open before us, and it is impossible both to see the invisible elements and, through the blended compounds, to discern individually the character of each ingredient that went into the mixture. What is left, then, but the necessity of suspending judgment? And do not the following facts urge us not to place too much trust in things unclear, facts spread, so to speak, across nearly the whole inhabited world, common to Greeks and barbarians alike, bringing with them the slipperiness that comes from judging? What, then, are these facts? Surely the upbringings from childhood, the ancestral customs, and the ancient laws, not one of which is agreed to be the same among all peoples, but which vary by region and nation and city, or rather even by village and by each individual household, man and woman and infant child are utterly distinguished in this respect. Things shameful among us are noble among others, and things fitting are unseemly, and things just are unjust, and things unholy are holy, while things lawful are unlawful, and further things blameworthy are praiseworthy, and things liable to punishment are worthy of honor, and so with all the other things people hold in ways opposite to one another. And why should I speak at length, drawn away as I am by other more pressing matters? Yet if someone wished, without being led off by any newer spectacle, to spend his time on the topic proposed and go through the customs, habits, and laws of each region, nation, city, place, subject peoples, and rulers, famous and obscure, free and enslaved, laymen and experts, not for one day or two, nor even for a month or a year, but should wear out his whole life at it, and use the whole span of an age, he would nonetheless leave behind, no less than before, many things unexamined, unconsidered and unspoken. Since then, things among different peoples differ not by a small margin only but are utterly at odds, so as to stand in opposition and conflict with one another, it is necessary that the impressions that strike us also differ, and that judgments be at war with one another. Given this, who is so out of his mind and so deluded as to declare firmly that such and such a thing is just, or wise, or noble, or advantageous? For whatever this person defines, another, trained from childhood in the opposite view, will invalidate. For my part, I am not surprised that a mixed and jumbled crowd, an inglorious slave to whatever customs and laws happen to have been introduced, learning from its very swaddling clothes to obey them as masters or tyrants, its soul beaten down and unable to attain a great and youthful boldness of thought, puts its trust in what has been handed down once for all, and, leaving its mind untrained, deals in unexamined and unquestioned assents and denials. But what is surprising is that even the multitude of so-called philosophers, who pretend to hunt after clarity and truth among existing things, are split into bands and companies holding discordant doctrines, often even contrary ones, not about some one-chance question, but about nearly everything, small and great, on which their inquiries turn. For those who maintain that the universe is infinite are opposed by those who say it is finite. Those who declare the cosmos ungenerated are opposed by those who assert it is generated. And those who kindle an irrational, self-generating motion with no overseer or guide are opposed by those who suppose there is a wondrous providence and care over the whole and its parts, exercised by a God who guides and steers it without stumbling and to its preservation. How, then, could such people arrive at the same grasp of the very same underlying realities? And do not the impressions concerning the inquiry into the good likewise compel us to suspend judgment rather than to agree, since some hold that the good is the noble alone and store it up in the soul, while others parcel it out into several kinds, extending it even to the body and to external things? These people say that strokes of fortune are the bodyguards of the body, while health, strength, wholeness, and precision of the senses, and whatever else is of that kind, belong to the ruling soul. For since the nature of the good is arranged in three ranks, the third and outermost is a champion for the second, which yields to it, while the second has become a great bulwark and safeguard for the first. And concerning these very matters, the difference among ways of life, the ends to which all our actions ought to be referred, and countless other things contained in logical, ethical, and physical inquiry, there have arisen innumerable speculations, not one of which has to this day been agreed upon by all the skeptics. It is not without reason, then, that the mind is introduced using ignorance of knowledge concerning his two daughters, counsel and consent, once they had been joined to him and had lain with him. For it is said, he did not know when they lay down and when they rose, Gen 19:33-35. For he seems to grasp neither sleep nor waking, neither state nor motion, clearly and firmly. Rather, precisely when he seems to have deliberated best, it is then above all that he is found to be most bereft of counsel, since the outcome of events does not match what was expected. And whenever he thought fit to set his signature to certain things as true, he reaps the condemnation that comes from rashness, since the very things he had earlier trusted as most secure proved to be untrustworthy and unstable. So, since events tend to turn out contrary to what one has suspected, the safest course is to suspend judgment. Having discussed these matters sufficiently, let us turn to what follows in our argument. We said that drunkenness reveals gluttony as well, which often does great harm to many, in whose devotees one can observe that even when they have filled up all the receptacles of the body, their desires still remain empty. These people, even when they become glutted from the abundance of what they have stuffed themselves with, and like athletes, let their bodies catch their breath for a short while, strip again for the same contests. At any rate, the king of the land of Egypt, having become angry, as it seemed, with his cupbearer, the minister of the body's drunkenness, is introduced in the sacred books not long after being reconciled with him, having been reminded of the passion that bursts open the desires, on the day of a perishable birth, not in the imperishable light of the unborn. For it is said, it was Pharaoh's birthday, Gen 40:20, on which he sent for the chief cupbearer out of the prison for a libation feast. For it is characteristic of the passion lover to consider generated and perishable things splendid, because of his deep use of night and darkness in relation to the knowledge of imperishable things. For this reason, he immediately narrates the drunkenness that leads off pleasure and its minister. There are three who serve as household stewards and attendants of the licentious and unrestrained soul: the chief baker, the chief cupbearer, and the chief cook, whom the most admirable Moses recalls in these words: "And Pharaoh was angry with his two eunuchs, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and put them in custody with the chief jailer." Gen 40:2-3. And the chief cook, too, is a eunuch, for it is said elsewhere, "Joseph was brought down into Egypt, and a eunuch of Pharaoh, the chief cook, acquired him." Gen 39:1, and again, "They sold Joseph to Pharaoh's eunuch, the chief cook." Gen 37:36. Why, then, is neither a man nor a woman entrusted with any of the tasks mentioned at all? Is it not because men are by nature trained to sow seed, and women to receive it, and their union has come to be the cause of generation and of the permanence of the universe, whereas a soul that is barren and sterile, or rather, made a eunuch, by expensive foods and drinks and elaborately seasoned delicacies, rejoices in these, being unable either to sow the truly male seeds of virtue or to receive and rear what has been sown, but is by nature fit, like a poor and stony field, only for the destruction of things meant to live forever. Hence he lays down a most universal doctrine, namely, that the artisan of pleasure is barren of wisdom, being neither male nor female, since he is capable neither of giving nor of receiving the seeds that lead to imperishability, but practices instead the most shameful practice against life at destroying imperishable things and quenching the ever-burning lamps of nature that are meant to remain. None of such persons does Moses permit to come into the assembly of God. For he says, "He who is crushed or cut off shall not enter the assembly of the Lord." Deut. 23:1. For what benefit is there to one barren of wisdom in listening to sacred words, when he has been cut off from the faculty of preserving the trust and deposit of the most life-benefiting doctrines? There are, then, three caretakers of the human race: the chief baker, the cupbearer, and the caterer, reasonably so, since we desire the use and enjoyment of three things: solid food, delicacies, and drink. But some of us use only what is necessary, which we require by necessity in order to live healthily and without servility, while others use what is immoderate and utterly superfluous, things which tend to burst open the appetites, and by weighing down and pressing the body's receptacles with their bulk, breed great and manifold diseases. Now those who are private individuals with respect to pleasure, desire, and passion, like the common people in cities, live an unenvied and untroubled life, since they need little. They have no need of the art of elaborate and fussy servants, but make use of a plain kind of service: cooks, cupbearers, bakers. But those who consider living pleasantly to be lordship and kingship, and refer everything, small and great alike, to this end, think it fitting to employ chief cooks, chief cupbearers, and chief bakers as their servants. That is, men who have brought each of the arts they were trained in to its utmost perfection. For the most accomplished bakers practice the most varied kinds of unleavened cakes, honey cakes, and other unfermented pastries, elaborated not only in the different materials used, but also in the manner of preparation and in their shapes, so as to deceive not only the sense of taste, but also that of sight. And the concerns of the chief cupbearers have to do with the examination of wine, whether it is quickly absorbed and does not cause headache, or, on the contrary, is flowery and most fragrant, whether it takes a great or a small mixture with water for a drink suited to vigorous and intense occasions, or to a gentle and relaxed one, and all such practices as belong to those who have arrived at the very end of their art. As for fish and fowl and similar things, and however many other delicacies there are to season pleasantly, the caterers who are exceedingly skilled in this knowledge are ready at hand, devising countless things beyond what they have heard or seen, but out of continuous practice and rehearsal in matters of luxury, and dissolute and enfeebled clever at devising an unlivable life. But indeed all these have been shown to be eunuchs, barren of wisdom, whereas the one with whom the king of the belly, the mind, makes his reconciling libations was the cupbearer. For the human race is by nature fond of wine, and with respect to this alone especially insatiable, since while no one is completely unsated by sleep, food, intercourse, and the like, nearly everyone is by unmixed wine, and most of all those in whom the practice is cultivated. For having drunk, they are still thirsty, and they begin from the smaller cups, but as they proceed they order the wine to be poured from lesser jugs. And when, having become somewhat heated, they grow warm, no longer able to master themselves, they bring out the wine ladles and the bumpers and whole mixing bowls, and gulp down the unmixed wine all at once, until they are either overcome by deep sleep, or, once their capacity is filled, what is being poured in overflows. But even then, their insatiable craving still rages within them like a ravenous hunger. "For their vine is of the vine of Sodom," says Moses, "and their branch of Gomorrah, their grape is a grape of gall, their cluster is bitterness to them, their wine is the fury of dragons and the incurable fury of asps." Deut. 32:32-33. Now Sodom is interpreted as barrenness and blindness, and he likens to the vine and its produce those who are enslaved to wine drunkenness, gluttony, and the most shameful pleasures. What he darkly signifies is this. No plant of true joy has grown in the soul of the base person, since it has not made use of healthy roots, but roots that have been burnt and reduced to ash. When, instead of water, heaven rained down the unquenchable fiery bolts of God, who justly executed judgment against the impious. And the unrestrained desire, which is barren of noble things and blind to everything worth beholding, he is likened to the vine, not the mother of cultivated fruits, but the vine that has become the bearer of bitterness, wickedness, villainy, wrath, fury, and the most irascible tempers, biting the soul like venomous vipers and asps in ways wholly incurable. May we pray that God, the Master of all, in his mercy avert these things from us, so that he may destroy this wild vine, and vote for the eunuchs and all who are barren of virtue a most fitting exile, and in their place plant in our souls the cultivated trees of right instruction, and grant us noble and truly manly fruits and words, capable of sowing noble deeds, capable of increasing the virtues together, and sufficient to hold together and forever preserve the whole kinship of happiness.